All right, good morning, everyone. I'd like to thank the organizers for thinking of me and asking me to come and tell you about the radium EDM experiment at Argonne National Lab. So you already saw a lot of this in Blaine's talk, there are many places where CP violation can occur. Here are just a few of the parameters. So I won't talk too much about these guys because we'll hear about that after the coffee break. In the nuclear center, there's a whole bunch of places where EDMs could be hiding. There are a number of experiments looking for it. Especially in the nuclear sector, because there are so many places, because the nuclear sector couples to so many different possible CP violating sources, it's really important to have many experiments in that region. In order to fully constrain the space of possible CP violation parameters. Conversely, if you did happen to see an EDM in any one experiment, one EDM signal doesn't give you a whole lot of resolving power because pretty much any theory could explain one EDM. It becomes more difficult when a theory has to explain an EDM in one place but it all results someplace else or something like this. So for those reasons, you really want to have a lot of experiments. And so I'll talk about the radium one in particular. As kind of a side note, I always throw up these exemplar experiments. I think this is the first time I've been in a room with even more than two of these experiments, or even more than one of these experiments in the same room. All three of these experiments are represented here today. So thanks for thinking me also. Let me try to explain why we're looking at radium. We heard a little bit about in previous talks yesterday, I think, especially, it's, for example, in mercury, but in most nuclei, the EDM is due essentially to the valence nuclei in that system kind of polarizing the core nucleus. And so most of the EDM is actually due to the EDM of kind of one additional nuclei. In the case of mercury, it's largely sensitive to the neutron. In radium, however, radium is one of the few species on the atomic periodic.
Did you want this talk recorded?
Oh, I should probably put this on.
In the case of radium, however, radium is one of the few nuclei which is thought to have this octopole deformation. Gives it kind of a pear shape or egg shape like this. What this means is that the entire nucleus is working together collectively to create a much enhanced EDM compared to these other kind of species. That enhancement, it can be very large, depending on exactly what you're talking about. The enhancement factor is a few hundred to a few thousand compared to, for example, mercury. If you can do a similar experiment at a similar level of sensitivity, your physics reach is much greater in terms of underlying CP parameter space. So now that I've talked you all into doing radium experiments, let me try to talk you out of it. Radium is a radioactive species. Radium-226 is Marie Curie's element. Occurs naturally in the earth and in your drinking water and stuff. That's actually not useful for us because it has spin zero. Instead, we need to use radium-225, which has a half-life of 15 days. And the only place where you can get radium-225 is from the decay of thorium-229. That's the main source right now, and we get that from Oak Ridge National Lab in quantities of less than a microgram per month. That's really kind of the world supply of radium-225 as we understand it. There's nobody else who's in this business of making radium-225. This is pretty much all of it that we can get. What this means in practice is that we can order radium-225 and then put it into our vacuum apparatus, and then for the next 2 weeks we work feverishly to collect as much data as we can before it all decays away. The other not so nice thing about radium is that in order to attain the same kind of vapor pressures that you see in the mercury experiment with these beautiful vapor cells, we'd need to operate at 450 degrees centigrade. And at those temperatures, none of this works. The radium reacts with anything that you put it inside of, and it's all gone. You really can't do that kind of experiment. If you could think of a way to do that, you can actually make a ton of money because you make fantastic magnetometers. Basically, this is a showstopper. So instead, what we'd like to do is use the modern techniques of atomic physics in order to make the best possible use of the small number of atoms that we do have. What that is basically euphemism for we want to make a mott of radium atoms. So first you look at the atomic level structure of radium to see if you can do this. From the ground state, there's only one strong laser transition at 483 nanometers from here to the singlet P1 state. Unfortunately, you can't use that transition for much of anything because it decays very readily into these long-lived metastable D states. So it's very leaky. If you wanted to use that transition, you have to repump all of these states here. So that's very problematic. So instead, we use this much weaker transition at 714 nanometers. If you remember your dipole selection rules, this is actually a forbidden transition. But in radium, it's allowed because it's so heavy, the spin orbit coupling is large enough for this to matter. When we do that, this is nearly cycling. Most of the time, we could just use 714. But occasionally, we throw in one repump at 1428 in order to keep the cycling going a little bit further. One side effect, nice side effect of using this weak transition is because it's so narrow, we get a naturally low Doppler temperature of around 7 microkelvin, which is a speed of 2.8 centimeters per second. So this is the atoms are really moving very slowly, even compared to, for example, like ultra-cold neutrons or something. Another nice thing is radium-225 does have spin 1/2, and Blaine told you all the goodies associated with that. Once you kind of understand the atomic level structure, now you can try to make a mod of barium or radium, and we've been doing that for a while. So this is basically what the apparatus looks like. We get some radium nitrate, throw it in with a little bit of barium, and heat that whole thing up to about 500 degrees centigrade. Then the barium reduces the radium nitrate, and you get radium metal spewing out all over the place into your vacuum system. From this point on, you do everything with lasers. You collimate the atomic beam with lasers, you slow the atomic beam with lasers, and then you trap and cool the atomic beam with lasers. That gives us a radium mott. This is a few hundred thousand radium atoms at a temperature of about 40 microkelvin. Just as a side note, one nice thing about having the radium-226 is that this is actually what we can use most of the time for calibration purposes because it's so abundant and long-lived. It makes our life a lot easier most of the time. However, pretty much all the results I'll show you today are done with radium-225 because that's a science isotope. So, all right, now you have the MOTS. You think, well, okay, now you can do an EDM experiment. Well, not really. The thing is, there are basically two big things that you need to do the EDM experiment is an electric field and a strong electric field and a nice uniform magnetic field. So in the first case, a strong electric field requires the electrodes to be very close to these atoms. And if you put electrodes there, you would obstruct the atomic beam and any lasers that you try to throw in order to make the magneto-optical trap. So you can't really do that. You could maybe imagine moving the electrodes in and out on some motorized stage or something. So you could maybe work around that. But another problem is that by the nature of a mott, the mott likes to live in the place where the magnetic field is zero. If you apply a magnetic field, it'll just go to some place where the magnetic field is zero. And if there is no such place, it'll vanish. For those two reasons, you can't really do the EDM experiment in a mott. You have to at least transfer it to some other kind of trap. And we'd like to transfer it to a kind of trap that we can move and bring the atoms into a place of where we have all of that kind of nice apparatus. That kind of trap is called an optical dipole trap. Basically, you take 50 watts of an infrared laser and focus it down onto your atoms. When you do that, so this is the cloud of radium atoms, and you can see here the little stripe of the optical dipole trap. And then you can load the atoms from one kind of trap into the other with pretty high efficiency, 50 or 70%. So now you have it loaded into the optical dipole trap. Now what you want to do is move the atoms. So this is, as I told you, the atoms are attracted to the place where the intensity is great. That place is the place where the focus is. And so if you move the focus, you move the atoms. Well, this is quite easy because to move a focus, you just move the lens that makes that focus. So that's what we do. We have our big lens on this basically air hockey table. It's a magnetically actuated translation stage that can move this lens back and forth. So we move the lens that moves the atoms from here into the science chamber. When we do that, it looks kind of like a big cigar shape. Here's a picture of a few thousand 226 atoms. It's, you know, half a centimeter long and a few tenths of microns in diameter. But we don't want it to be so long, because the smaller the atoms are, the less we have to worry about various systematic effects like B-field gradients. So what we do is we actually overlap a second optical dipole trap perfectly on top of the first, like so. And then we use cooling lasers to crush down those atoms and force them into the overlap between the two. When we do that, the atoms are now in a nice little sphere, about 30 microns in diameter, and they'll just hang out there for tens of seconds. This is basically the shadow of a few hundred radium atoms. No, it's dominated probably by the stability, pointing stability of the lasers. Which slowly heats the atoms. So that's actually a major point of research, is finding where all that is. Tens of seconds, though, is kind of, people don't do much better than that in optical dipole traps. Like kind of 50 to 100 seconds is about what you can expect. So okay, now the atoms are where we have all this nice stuff. Here we have big cosine theta coils, high voltage electrodes, non-magnetic vacuum equipment, mu metal shields. So now kind of we're all ready for the EDM experiment. This is just a picture of the apparatus, basically. Here's the Zeeman slower that's about 1 meter long, Mott chamber, glass tube. The electrodes are kind of hiding out way back here. Mu metal shields, cosine theta coil. We got these designs from Blaine and Norville some years ago and adapted it for our experiment. All right, so now we have the atoms kind of where we want them, but now we need to prepare and detect their spin state. We do this in a way very similar to Blaine's talk. We prepare the state with optical pumping. We just use sigma polarized light until we drive them into the stretched Zeeman state. There's no need in our case for the chopper because we have comparatively few atoms. And we can detect them in the same way, because in this Zeeman state, you'll get a little bit of fluorescence before decaying into before being pumped into the dark state. But if you're already in the dark state, then if you apply a sigma pulse light, you won't see any more fluorescence. It'll be dark. Just kind of a side note, we also basically are looking at the absorption signal of the atoms. So in Blaine's talk, they use the Faraday effect. Essentially, they kind of detune the laser and use the Faraday effect. But we're actually looking at the absorption of the atoms from the laser light. What that means is that we can actually plot out the Lamar precession. Barely shows up, but we plot out the Lamar precession basically just by plotting the opacity of the cloud as a function of time. That allows us to plot out as the spin goes, like so. So way up here, the atoms absorb a lot of light, but if you wait like one full period, they're already back in their prepared state, so you don't really get any absorption at that point. If you wait one half period, however, they're back into the bad state again, and so they absorb many photons. All right. So to kind of review the experimental cycle, this is again very similar to previous talks. We prepare the state, allow it to process for a little while, and then we turn on the electric field and turn it off again. And so while the electric field is on, if there's an EDM, there will be a small frequency shift, like so. And over this time t, you'll build up a phase. You'll build up a phase shift delta phi. So all of this stuff, like in the previous talk, happens in the dark. We don't see any of that. But then we turn off the electric field and detect the atoms in order to see if there's any phase shift here. So we're not really looking at a frequency difference directly. We're looking at a phase shift in particular. So we had all these pieces working back in the, near the end of 2014. So we decided to start just collecting some data, and we got data that looks like this. So you have basically blue is E field up and red is B field down. So as I said, basically any phase shift between these points would correspond to an EDM. It looks very small here, and in fact, there is no statistically resolved effect. So we get our first EDM of radium to be less than 5 × 10⁻²² E centimeters. We're very proud of this result. It's the first time not only that the EDM has been measured in an octopole deformed nucleus, but also the first time it's ever been measured in a laser-cooled atomic system. So we got all that. We put it all together and got it, sent it off to get published. And while that was happening, we made a few improvements to the apparatus. We increased the lifetime. At the time, it was more like 2 seconds, and we cranked it up to more like 20 seconds. We increased the activity and made some changes to our data collection system to kind of not waste as much data, essentially. And so then, even before that result actually hit PRL, we had new data. Looks more like this. Again, red data points is up, blue is down. And that represented a 36-fold improvement from our previous result. Now it's at 1.4 × 10⁻²² E centimeters. So kind of what you're essentially seeing here, things are moving very quickly now. Kind of what you're seeing here is now that we have a working apparatus, we have something to tune. And kind of as we're tuning, we're measuring EDMs. So things progress very rapidly in this case. It makes sense to think a little bit about the systematics that we don't see and that we could potentially anticipate in the future. So we did a systematic search survey of all those things. In the current experiment, we measured everything to be less than 2 × 10⁻²⁵ E centimeters. But this is limited by the statistics of our measurement, essentially. And so as things improve, we anticipate not seeing anything until at least 5 × 10⁻²⁷ E centimeters in the current apparatus. This is, of course, an upper bound on where we would expect to see any kind of systematics. We're very conservative about where we would expect to start seeing anything. Even if you did see something here, there are some improvements you could make to the apparatus that would push it down at least into the 10⁻²⁹ E centimeter region. One thing we did notice, one kind of upshot to doing that analysis, was that we noticed there's one parameter, the angle of the magnetic field, especially with respect to the electric field, that couples into a number of our systematics that wasn't very well controlled. So we decided to improve on that. It's one thing we've done over the last couple of months is we have a way of calibrating. We have a vector magnetometer, and we have a way of calibrating those axes to an optical prism. And so we can use that optical prism to align the magnetic field to the electrodes and to other things in the apparatus with a precision better than 1 millirad, which for our purposes is fine into the foreseeable future. So basically what this all means is that we expect to be statistics limited into the distant future. So how are we going to improve on our statistical sensitivity? This is kind of the way that I think of the statistical sensitivity of the experiment. There's just the precession time, the electric field, person lifetime, and your SNR. So there are a few things that we can do to improve the electric field and the SNR in particular. The SNR I'll talk about first. Right now, the SNR per shot is something like one, a little bit less than one per cycle. But the atom shot noise limit is more like 20. So we're very far from the atom shot noise limit, and we want to talk about how we'll get there. So as I mentioned before, basically the way we do our detection now is that we hit the atoms with circularly polarized light, and if it's in this state, you'll get a few photons, but if it's that state, you won't. What you actually get is about 2 photons before the atoms decay into the dark state. What this means is that you're kind of forever photon shot noise limited rather than atom shot noise limited, because you'll never even really collect both of those photons. And then on top of that, you have this giant photon background from your absorption image. So we want to, this is kind of a crazy way of doing things, really. People have been doing it differently for quite a while. In fact, there's the old technique of electron shelving, where we want to coherently move one of these 2 Zeeman states from the ground state into one of our metastable D states, using a technique called STRAP. Once you do that coherent transfer, now you can just sort of count the number of atoms that are left over in the ground state by cycling on this other transition for it basically indefinitely. So that allows you to move from about 2 photons per atom to about 1,000 photons per atom, which will bring you essentially to the atom shot noise limit. So there is a nominal improvement of a factor of 20 or so. Another place where we can win is in electric field. Right now with our copper electrodes, we demonstrate something like 70 kilovolts per centimeter. But because our atoms are so small, our electrode gap can be very small, like 1 or 2 millimeters. And so what 70 kilovolts per centimeter actually isn't very good in that regime. State of the art is more like around 500 kilovolts per centimeter. So we're working with some of the people who have demonstrated that before in titanium or niobium. And so that we expect to give us another factor of maybe 5 or 7 in EDM sensitivity. That's an effect, again, just linear in the electric field. The EDM is just linear in the electric field. So that improvement is a straight up improvement in EDM sensitivity. So between those two things, we expect a factor of 100 increase that should bring us to the kind of high 10 to the minus 26 E centimeter level. I forgot to mention, I'm actually anxiously awaiting, Michael Bischoff, our postdoc, tells me that he's testing this technique like today. So I've been anxiously looking on the on our e-log to see if he would throw some data up before the talk, but he hasn't yet. And the electric field is work ongoing. So this just kind of summarizes where all these improvements are going. Blaine had a slide like this, except from the other end of things. Once we're at the 10 to the minus 25 E centimeter level, these are the best global fit, the best solutions for the global fit of all these parameters. And factor improvements as radium gets better. So at the 10 to the minus 25 E centimeter level, you can see we're putting a little bit of pressure on all of these parameters. And at 10 to the minus 26, it's a really very significant improvement. These 2 points are the ones we've taken already. This is the one I've just talked about. And here are some upcoming improvements. Notice this isn't really going to be exponential in time. Notice the aspirational dates near the bottom. So at this point, we'll have pretty much the best electric field that we could reasonably hope for. In the lifetime, you know, you could maybe improve a little bit, but it'll be small change, I think. So now you really have to work, and you're at the atom shot noise limit, so really you have to work on getting more atoms at this point. One way to do that is to improve the efficiency. Right now, the overall efficiency of the apparatus is kind of 1 in a million atoms. Part of the reason for this is because of our Zeeman solver. As I described, we use the weak transition to do everything. And as a result, we really only get atoms moving slower than about 60 meters per second loaded into the trap. If we could somehow use this blue transition, the strong transition, we could bring that up to more like 300 meters per second, at which point we're capturing kind of half of all of these available atoms. And that will give us something like a factor of 100 improvement in the atom number. So there's another factor of 10 roughly in EDM sensitivity. Thinking even further into the future, new sources of radium are being worked on and are coming online. For example, EFRIB is expected to build to make almost 100 times as much radium, 225 is available today. Here are some calculations for Brad Sherrill. This EFRIB is expected to start coming online sometime in 2020 and beyond. And we're thinking now about ways that we can demonstrate, kind of prove this principle of production and extraction of radium. I've been kind of learning that one of the few things that is known about radium chemistry is how to extract it from water, because the EPA does this in order to monitor the amount of radium in your drinking water. So this is exactly the technology that you need to extract radium from the EFRIB beam dump. So with that, I'd like to thank you all for your attention, and thank all the people that I get to work with every day.
Are there more questions for Matt?
Why do you ramp your electric field while your atoms are already prepared? You get big displacement currents, which could be an issue.
Right. Yeah.
Different. So, I mean, can't you apply your potential first and now transfer your atoms and not have that problem?
Yeah, we can potentially move to that. Right now, we're worried more about the E squared effect induced by the Stark shift, more than we're worried about the various currents associated with that ramping. That's what we call this E field ramping. And right now we kind of expect that to create a false signal around the 10 to the minus 27 level. So for quite a while, we're not worried about that. This is kind of one benefit of working in radium. Because you have this enhancement, you can be lazier about things like that. So we probably will move to that eventually so we can remove any concern of that type. But at the moment, we're more worried about the Stark shift. Yeah.
How would they determine? Do you have some way of exaggerating all the effects?
Yeah. Some of them, basically what we do is we think of the most ridiculous model we can and use that. In other places, it's...
That's not a measure.
No. Well, so like I said, we didn't... We looked for a bunch of correlations, for example, between the optical dipole trap power and the high voltage, and the power and frequency of other parts of the experiment. We didn't see any correlations anyplace. Because of the place where our statistics are, all we can do for everything else is anticipate where we expect we should see it.
That's the origin of my question.
Yeah. So like for example, the E squared effects, what we do is we measure at zero field as well. And so that gives us a measure of whether or not there's any E squared type effect, and we don't see anything. And then what we say is, well, but we also have a measure of the electric field at the atoms, and we know that that's also the same to better than some precision. And so that's what allows us to lever down in, you know, to 10 to the minus 25 when our nominal sensitivity is only 10 to the minus 23. So I have a little bit of a hard time answering your question because for each of these it's a little bit different. For some of these, like Stark interference, like I really just calculate, you expect to eventually see Stark interference. It's not really a systematic because you correct for it, but you expect to see it at about this level. Of course, we don't have that sensitivity, so of course it isn't a measurement. But even when we hit that level, it won't really be a systematic.
I have a question about an ancillary experiment. In particular, when people consider the radium-225 system, they're keen on it because, in principle, the occipital deformation can be permanent. It might be a more readily calculable shift moment than in the case of mercury-199. And to that end, there have been studies at Isolde of Coulomb excitation of radium-226 that established that, in fact, in that level of mass lemma, in fact, permanent deformation existed.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm wondering, is it possible to study radium-225 precisely in such a system, in Isolde, and try to determine ancillary experimental parameters that might help make a shift moment calculation more robust?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is actually the nuclear group at Argonne has been working on this for a while now, like Yi and Robert have been working on this. To measure in 225. 225 is a lot harder because, for a variety of reasons, the nuclear structure is just harder to access, but also there's a whole lot less of it than 226. So for those two reasons, they've run into walls so far, but they hope that they can improve on their source and get the statistics they need for that measurement. But yeah, there is active effort in that direction to directly measure the occipital deformation.
So I have a question. It seems that right now your main effort is on increasing the statistics and the number of atoms in your trap.
Yeah.
So what's preventing you from actually putting an atom in the cell?
From putting?
So like a mercury experiment.
Oh, so basically you could put it in the cell, but there would be no vapor pressure, right? You need to heat it up. It's just the nature of alkali earths that they have this low vapor pressure. So if you heat it up, people do this a lot because there's a lot of interest in these types of species for magnetometry. So there's been a lot of effort in inventing cells that can do that. But whenever you heat anything to 500 degrees centigrade, it reacts with the cell. So you get some complex instead of getting radium vapor. Or, you know, strontium vapor or something. So I don't think anyone's actually tried to do this in radium. Because it's like the radioactive mess you would make doing all that chemistry is more than anyone wants to think about. But in very similar species, people try and without any success.
So this is fantastic. You're developing the, you know, kind of starting to use the most modern methods for doing this measurement. But then, you know, the question is the enhancement you get from radium is within an order of unity of the enhancement that you have in other atoms, or was I mistaken?
The enhancement?
Was it a factor of three different than mercury?
No, it's from mercury, it's like a factor. In the CP, in sensitivity to CP violating parameters, it's like a few hundred to a few thousand.
Okay.
I see. I know what you're probably talking about. You're probably talking about this here. When I say this factor of a few hundred to a few thousand, there are a few things that go into that. And one of them is just that radium is heavier.
Yeah.
And that gives you a factor of about three. But that three is included in this overall enhancement factor.
The table with coefficients T1, T0,
So this is what G0 and G1 and G2. These are different models, but the biggest important thing is which of these G's are you talking about? Mercury has a very small sensitivity to the isovector part, so the enhancement is very big for that one.
Okay, thanks for clearing that up. And then I have a really boring question.
Okay.
Comparatively, I guess. Is the interactions between your atoms, when your N starts going up, when does that start kicking in as a possible systematic?
Yeah, so I think we'll probably never get there for kind of a different reason. Because I don't want the cloud to become optically thick, because then the detection scheme goes all to heck. So before that happens, I'm going to put the atoms into the ODT into a cavity and get a really large volume for those atoms.
Any other questions for Matt?
At the beginning, you showed this table of isotopes of a nuclear of atoms. Why is radon not considered in any way?
Why is radon? So radon is considered. Like Tim Chapa is working on this. It's a collaboration almost exactly as old as the radium collaboration, actually working on the radon. They're working at Triumph now, but they have basically production issues. Radon, I'm probably gonna bite my tongue here, but I think it's like a 4 hour, the relevant isotope is like a 4 hour lifetime or something. So they really have to make it online. They can't ship it anywhere. That isotope of radon is just hard to make. They can't use the regular 222 or whatever it is that comes out of the ground, because that's an even isotope. So it's a very challenging experiment. It would be great because that one is a vapor. So that one's basically a vapor cell measurement. But it's very challenging for other reasons.
This experiment will become possible? Afraid. So is this experiment will be possible when the freight come online and you can have a local setup at the facility and do this experiment?
For radium or radon? They probably looked into that. Different facilities are optimized for production of different things. They're also probably worried about the long time scale for EFRIB, because it won't even come online until 2020, and full beam probably isn't until 2025 or so. So for maybe EFRIB will also make radon. I can't say for sure, but at the moment they're working at Triumph.
Okay. Let's thank Matt and both speakers this morning, and we'll come back at 11 o'clock.